This week's parasha is Parashas Vayikra, and we'll start from the beginning of the parasha, which you can find on page 544. Okay. Vayikra el Moshe. And he, referring to Hashem, called to Moshe. Vayadaber Hashem elav, and Hashem spoke to him. Vayoyhol moyed leimar, from the tent of meaning from the Mishkan, from the tabernacle, saying. Now, on these three words, Vayikra el Moshe, the Medrash has a very interesting comment. And the Medrash comments that Moshe Rabbeinu had 10 names. Now, what that means is that from a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, from a pasuk in the Book of Chronicles, from other sources in the Torah, we find Moshe being referred to not by his name Moshe, but with other names. So Moshe, essentially, we find in the Torah is called in many ways other than Moshe. And therefore, the question would be, why did Hashem seemingly choose Moshe as the primary name? And it seems to focus it on the fact that it says, Vayikra el Moshe, he called to Moshe. That's where the Medrash brings us down. It seems there's something here specifically that means something more over the fact that when Hashem is calling, he's calling to Moshe. And he's calling Moshe by his name, Moshe. And the Medrash says that Hashem said to Moshe that although he clearly had other names, and other names would mean seemingly, I don't know if that means by his bris, his father gave him 10 names. Because I don't know if that's what it means. But it means is that every name, especially a name of the Torah, or every name is really that way, really is the spiritual definition of every person. Every person's spiritual DNA, every person's spiritual makeup lies in his name. And there's a tradition that when a father gives a child their name, there's a malach that comes, an angel comes and puts the name in the father's mouth. It's not just random. It's meant to define the person. It's meant to be a way of defining the essence of the person. We don't necessarily know how to do that, but that's what lies in a name. And therefore, all the different names of Moshe really are expressions of the different aspects of Moshe's essence and Moshe's greatness. But Hashem said to Moshe, I'm going to call you by the name that Basya, the daughter of Parah, used when she took you out of the water. That's the name I'm going to use. We know that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was a baby, the Torah doesn't tell us when he's born what his name was. He was put into a basket by his mother. The daughter of Parah went ahead and found him. She took him back to the palace. He was raised in the palace. Okay, part of the time he was by his mother. Then afterwards, when he was weaned, he went to the palace. And the Torah tells us that she called him Moshe. Kiminamayim ishisiyu, because from the water I drew him out. And Hashem says, of all the names that could have been used for Moshe in the Torah, Hashem says, I'm picking the name that the daughter of Parah chose for you. The Medrash doesn't seem, though, to explain why. What was so special about that name more than any other names?
Did she speak Hebrew?
Whatever it was. But the point it doesn't matter. The point is, whatever she said in Egyptian is translated in Hebrew. That's what it is. The Medrash doesn't really tell us why did Hashem choose this name more than any other name. So I always thought, I don't know if I saw this somewhere, but I always thought that the reason why that Hashem chose Moshe's name, what that means is that by choosing the name Moshe, which means I drew him out of the water, every time we mention Moshe, we're supposed to be thinking about how Basya drew him out of the water. There's something about always remembering that. There's something about always remembering that Moshe was given that name because Basya, the daughter of Parah, drew him out of the water. And the purpose to go ahead and always remember that is because clearly for Basya, the daughter of Parah, to do what she did to save Moshe, especially after she discovered and saw that he was a Hebrew child, which there was a decree to drown, and she went ahead and she saved him, clearly was a great act on her part. It's an act that we call Mesiras Nefesh, self-sacrifice. It was an easy thing to do. According to the Medrash, according to the Gemara in Saita, her maidservants that were with her were pressuring her not to save the baby. And she saved the baby anyway. And she brought it back to the palace, of all things. That was, that to do this was an act of called Mesiras Nefesh, self-sacrifice on her part. Which means that every time we mention Moshe's name, we're being reminded of the self-sacrifice that made it possible for us to have Moshe. Moshe is a product of Mesiras Nefesh. Moshe is a product of the dedication of self-sacrifice of an individual to do the right thing. And that is what we're always, that's why Hashem chose the name Moshe. We should always remember how we have Moshe. We have Moshe because of someone's dedication and self-sacrifice. And that the product of that self-sacrifice was this great man Moshe. And that as a general lesson, we see that when a person is Moshe Nefesh, when a person does act with great dedication and self-sacrifice, that the product of that self-sacrifice is going to be something great. Now, you know, when we talk about self-sacrifice, there's a lot of levels to that. You know, there's a small self-sacrifice, there's a big self-sacrifice, the biggest being giving up your life to sanctify God's name. Very often we refer to Mesiras Nefesh, refer to self-sacrifice as when a person gives up a lot on an ongoing basis, right? On a consistent basis, they give up a lot to go ahead and do something. It's not easy. You know, you give up a lot of time to go ahead and take care of someone in need. And it means you got to give up a lot from yourself to do it. And you do it on a consistent basis. That's also a strong level of self-sacrifice. Sometimes acts of self-sacrifice are one-time deals. In Basi's case, it was a one-time deal, seemingly. We don't see that she had problems with Moshe afterwards. You know, it was a one-time deal. But it was a big thing. To go ahead and to defy her father's command and to save a Hebrew child was a great act of self-sacrifice, of dedication. It was something that she was very hard to do because she realized that she was doing something against her father, which could be a dangerous thing. Still, she did it. That is what we're trying to remember and to take as a lesson from that, the fact that when that's just Moshe as a product of self-sacrifice. Anytime we manifest any kind of level of strong dedication of self-sacrifice to do something, that the product of that will be something great. Now, I'm going to share with you a thought, which is similar to this. It's a little bit different, but it brings out the same idea. And that is, this is a thought that I saw from Rav Nosson of Achtfeigel, Zatzal. He was the Mashkiach of the Lakewood Yeshiva. And it's actually a thought on Purim. And in the Megillah we find that when Esther was first taken to Ahasuerus' palace, she did not tell her lineage. She didn't tell her background. Why? Because Mordechai told her not to. That's what the Megillah stresses. Okay? The Megillah stresses that was because of that. That Megillah stresses that she listened to Mordechai. And when the decree of Haman came out to destroy the Jewish people, Mordechai goes to Esther. Mordechai says to Esther, you got to go into the king. Even though you haven't been called to the king, you got to go in. This is what you've been put into the palace for, to save the Jewish people. And she listens. She listens. And she's ready to, basically, now she's ready to give up her life to save the Jewish people. So what's interesting is that at this point, once she agrees to listen to Mordechai, now she goes and tells Mordechai, okay, everybody has to fast. And one has to understand the ramifications of that, of her request. Wasn't just like, you know, well, if I'm doing this, you do this. Because according to the Talmud, according to the Gemara, she bait one of the three, the fast took place on Purim, Pesach, sorry. When she had the Jewish people fasting on her behalf before Achashverosh, it was Pesach. So she basically told Mordechai, I want the Jewish people to fast on Pesach. And Mordechai said yes. Mordechai said yes. It almost seems like the tables were a little bit turned. Now she's the one who's in charge. We also find later on after the miracle of Purim, again, it's Esther who is the one. It's Esther mentioned before Mordechai. It's Esther that we find in the Gemara who makes who requests that the Sanhedrin, the men of the Great Assembly, establish Purim as a holiday for all generations. She seems to be the one now in charge. Beforehand, it was Mordechai, the one who was in charge, in the sense of who to listen to, and now she's the one in charge. She's the one in the lead. What changed? What happened? So Rav Bachweigel said what happened was, is that once Esther was, once she showed that self-sacrifice, once she showed that tremendous dedication, when that happens to you, the Rabbeinu Shalom showers upon you a high level of wisdom that you wouldn't have without it. It's that you get one of the rewards of Mesiras Nefesh, the rewards of being ready to give everything up in order to do the right thing. The reward of that was that she was now endowed with this greatness that now she's the one in charge. She's the one who's telling everybody what to do. And Mordechai will listen to her. And she'll take the lead in establishing Purim as a holiday. Because once she went ahead and she showed that self-sacrifice, now she was bestowed, she was blessed. She was showered with now a level of greatness and knowledge and understanding that now she's the one calling the shots. And Rav Bachweigel brings down a famous story with the Stei Chemed. The Stei Chemed, I don't know actually what his actual name was, because you know we kind of never know. We call people by the names of the Svarim. But the Stei Chemed, I believe it was a Sephardic. I believe, I may be wrong. But the Stei Chemed wrote, we could call it the first Jewish encyclopedia, the first Torah encyclopedia. The Stei Chemed is a work, it's a number of volumes, at least 10 volumes, I believe, where he takes a subject and he just writes everything about the subject. That's what kind of a Talmud Chacham he was. And the Stei Chemed is quoted very often. And he brings down everything on a subject. You can see what kind of tremendous Talmud Chacham he was. The story goes with the Stei Chemed that at one point of time when he was a young man, that he was part of a group of scholars that was studying full time and supported by a wealthy man. You know, that was the early concept of Kailo, in the sense where you took the best students, and a rich man would have his own shul or his own study hall, and he had a number of scholars studying there, and he would support them, and they studied to become great rabbis. And the Stei Chemed apparently was very beloved to this wealthy man. He was considered very beloved and very held in high esteem amongst all the other scholars in this group. But there was one scholar who was jealous. Really jealous. Really jealous to the point that he was going to do something to bring the Stei Chemed down. So what he did was, he went to one of the maids of this wealthy man, and he paid her off. And he told her to come to the Beis Medrash, to the study hall, and accuse the Stei Chemed of mistreating her. That's what he did.
What should she do?
She should come and accuse the Stei Chemed of mistreating her.
Of mistreating her.
Okay? And he paid her money, and she did it. She came in, and she accused him of violating her. And
a kind of harassment.
Yeah, that's what she accused him of. That's what she accused him of.
Now we understand where story starts. How long ago?
Well, the difference is this one was false. This one was false. She was paid to do it. Now, so she accused him, and of course, you know, accusations like that. As you say, that which we find nowadays, these accusations were taken very seriously. The other members of this group wanted to throw him out. You know, they were very quick to accept what she said, and they wanted to throw her out. They throw him out. But they realized that they cannot do it without permission, or they can't do it without first speaking to the balabas, to the person in charge of everything, and they can't just throw him out. There's a person in charge of everything. They have to ask him. Well, when he came around, they went and told him the story. He walked into the Beis Medrash, and he looked at the Stei Chemed. And the Stei Chemed was studying Torah as if nothing happened. She came in with accusations. He didn't flinch. He just kept studying Torah as if nothing happened. And the Balabas, who saw this, started to say Chemed, and he said, I don't believe her. I don't believe her. And I'm desperate because of her accusation, I'm not going to believe her. And the Seychemets came, and she got thrown out. She got thrown out. All right? So the Seychemets left in the Kailo. He's sitting and learning. Everybody else is sitting and learning. But clearly, you know, there are a lot of people who were not happy. And we're not ready to let the Seychemets, they were not ready to just go ahead and let him go. A short while later, the person who hired this woman to accuse him died. And then, after that, this woman, this maid who accused him, came crying to the Seychemet that she has no job, and she has no parnasa, and she has no livelihood. And she basically came to ask him for forgiveness. She came to ask him for forgiveness. All right. And she was ready to go ahead and tell everybody, you know, what really happened. So the Seychemet said to himself, if I let her go and tell everybody what happened, because she wants to get her job back, if I tell everybody what's going to happen, can you imagine what people are going to say? To hear you had a person studying Torah and went ahead and paid off a woman to falsely accuse him of doing a disgusting thing. Can you imagine the Chilul Hashem, the desecration of God's name that's going to come out of that? That someone who was seemingly a Torah scholar can go so low and do that? So he told her like this. You got to promise me that you're not going to tell anybody what happened, and I'm going to make sure you get a job. I will make sure you get a job. You have to promise me that you're never going to tell anybody what happened. And she agreed. She agreed, and she promised not to tell anybody what happened. And he got her a job. And the Seychemet said, eventually the Seychemet told the story over, and the Seychemet said that at that point of time that he decided that he was going to act to preserve the honor of Torah, he felt that the wellsprings of Torah just opened up to him on a much higher level. He felt that now he was endowed with the ability to understand and grasp and retain Torah in a level that he never had before. He felt that the wellsprings of Torah now opened up in him. All because of the fact that he went so far to do this. Clearly, this was a tremendous act of self-sacrifice. And the reward for that was this tremendous endowment of wisdom. That is what Rav Achtveigel suggested was also now what happened by Esther. When Esther also was ready to give up so much, she also was now endowed, which is tremendous. It's a tremendous level of knowledge and understanding. And therefore now she became the one in charge. Now that story, that this idea is about someone who they themselves were ready to give up so much and they were rewarded. You know, it doesn't say by Moshe that because Basti practiced self-sacrifice, she became a lot smarter. It doesn't say that. Even though she eventually did convert and become part of the Jewish people. But the idea is, a similar idea would be based on this idea that what is the result of self-sacrifice? What is the result of that kind of dedication? The same way it was a result in tremendous knowledge and tremendous greatness for Esther and for the Seychemet. It's the same idea. The self-sacrifice of Basia to save Moshe. What was the product of that self-sacrifice? The product of that self-sacrifice was this child that she saved and she raised. That was the product, the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore, perhaps the reason why the name that Hashem said, or I'm going to call you by, the name that always reminds us of the fact that Moshe was drawn out of the water, is the lesson in what are the results, what's the product of someone who goes through tremendous self-sacrifice to do the right thing and to serve Hashem. Okay, Pasuk Beis. Daber al b'nei Yisrael, speak to the b'nei Yisrael, v'amarta aleihem, and say to them, Adam, a person, ki yakriv mikem karban l'Hashem, who will offer from you a sacrifice to Hashem, min abehema, from a domesticated animal, min habakar, min atzayin, from cattle or from sheep, takrivu es karbanchem, shall you offer your sacrifice. Now last week, we went through the Sefer HaChinuch about the Beis HaMikdash, about karbanos, what karbanos are all about. And we see from the Sefer HaChinuch, from the Ramban, that we really can't have a real understanding of karbanos without knowing Kabbalah. But the sacrifices, again, all have lessons for us to learn from them, and those lessons were contributed to a person gaining atonement from the sacrifice. So the Rav Shamash Rafal Hirsch, in his commentary, makes a number of interesting points and symbolic meanings of what's going on here. Now, the first thing is, which is something that many commentaries say, the word carbon that we use, right? We translate carbon as a sacrifice, right? That's what we call it, a sacrifice. So Hirsch says that a sacrifice sounds like what we just said before, right? Self-sacrifice. When you're giving up something from yourself that it's not easy to give up. And, you know, so is that what we're trying to portray about a carbon? That a carbon is something that's not easy to give up in order to bring this animal as a gift to Hashem? Is it always hard to do? Is it always something that you have to sacrifice to do? Now, actually, the Sefer HaChinuch told us that is one of the ideas. One of the ideas is that the Torah wants us that to give up an animal which is worth a lot. And the Torah wants the poor man who only has flour and water to give that up so he should realize the severity of what he did. There is a certain level of that. But apparently Rav Hirsch doesn't like the idea of defining the word carbon just as the idea of sacrifice. Okay?
Admitting you what you did.
Well, okay, that's part of it. That's part of it.
It's not easy to say, hey, I did that.
Clearly not. But again, he doesn't like the idea. Yeah, okay. But again, to go into his sacrifice, you know, he says, my understanding is to give that the whole definition, which is typically what we do. You're not pleased with that because of that connotation. Sometimes use the word offering, right? An offering. He says the word offering has a connotation of that whatever is receiving your offer is gaining something from it. And Hashem doesn't gain from our sacrifices. And therefore, he says the essence of the word carbon, as Martin just said, is from the word karov, close. A carbon brings a person closer to Hashem. That's what it does. It creates a closeness. There's a unique closeness that a person develops with Hashem when he brings a carbon. We always wonder, how does that happen? You know, how? I took the animal and I slaughtered it. How does that happen? And we know that, unfortunately, you know, the other movements of the movements that were again not following Torah, they didn't want to talk about sacrifices. They don't talk about sacrifice. You know, again, I can't tell you what they do now. But originally, you know, Reform took sacrifices out of davening. There's no sacrifices. That's barbaric. That was at least. I mean, I don't know what's now, but clearly in the beginning, that's what they clearly they took that out. They took out carbonus. That had no more meaning. And the truth is, carbonus are difficult to understand. Okay, but at the end of the day, as Rav Hirsch says, the essence of a carbon is to bring a person closer to Hashem. And he also points out very interestingly that if you look at that, look again in the Pasuk Beis, Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'yamar to aleihem, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, Adam ki yakriv mikem, a person who will, you know, be makriv, will offer from you, karban l'Hashem, a karban to Hashem. Very, at any time the word karban is connected to Hashem's name, which name is used? This name of Yud, Hey, Vav, and Hey. You don't find a carbon Lelokim. You don't find a carbon to the God of just judgment. Elokim is Hashem's name. We're talking about strict judgment. A carbon is not a carbon to Elokim. Because the carbon is not to pacify, you know, the God of strict judgment and to get him to cool down. It's not meant to pacify an angry God or restrict God. But rather, it's a carbon to the merciful God. It's about Hashem's mercy. The carbon that we bring is all about Hashem's mercy. He's not doing it because it's a way of appeasing him. It's a way of the way he expresses his mercy to us, that we have the ability, even after we sin, to go ahead and become closer to him. So it's a carbon l'Hashem. It's a sacrifice to the name Hashem that represents Midas HaRachamim, the attribute of mercy. Okay? Let's look at the next pasuk. Im Ola Karbanai Min HaBakar. If his sacrifice is an Ola, a burnt offering, which means the whole thing is burnt, Min HaBakar, from cattle, Zachar, male, Tumim, whole, unblemished. Yakrivenu El Pesach HaOmayed, shall he bring it forth to the opening of the Mishkan. Yakri Vaisai, he shall bring it, that Yakri Vaisai L'Ritzayin L'Fnei Hashem. And he will offer it for his goodwill before Hashem. Or the way they translate it is he'll offer it voluntarily before Hashem. Okay, so here it says that the carbon has to be tumim. The carbon has to be whole, unblemished. To be unblemished. Now, some people could probably say, makes difference to Hashem if it has a blemish on it or not. What's the difference? So it has a little cut. It has a little something, right? It makes a difference to Hashem whether what it looks like, really? Hashem cares what it looks like? But the answer is, the simple answer is, the basic answer is that it's not about Hashem, it's about us. And if you could bring inferior quality animals, right? If you could bring something of inferior quality to offer to Hashem, then that shows that when you serve Hashem, you can do it with inferior quality. The fact that it has to be tumim, it has to be unblemished, has to be whole, means that when we are serving Hashem and coming close to Hashem, we have to do it in a way that is whole, not inferior, not in a way of inferior, but in the best way, but in a high quality. You know, I always think about this when I was one time in the Israel bookshop. Before Sukkos, okay? And, you know, we're standing around the Esregim, and a person comes over to me and he goes, does it really make a difference to Hashem what kind of Esreg I buy? Does it really make a difference to Hashem what kind of Esreg I buy? And, you know, there I was, like, in the middle of the store, a bunch of people around me. I can't remember what I answered. And I remember one woman responded, "Oh, come on. Oh, come on." But the idea is that, you know, when you want to present something nice in front of someone, right? You present the nicest that you can. Now the question is, okay, people don't understand by Esreg, you know, this one looks good to me. What's the difference? Okay, that's a different discussion. But the point is, though, that we do everything in a way that, you know, there's high quality and there's low quality, and everybody knows that. All right, so some people say, you know, I don't really have to do high quality things, too much money. You know, these things shouldn't make a difference, but it always does make a difference, you know. And that's the lesson here, that it has to be tumim. It has to be unblemished, because if your sacrifice of the way you're trying to become close to Hashem is low grade, then that means that you don't that you think, okay, I can serve Hashem with usually low quality, not high quality. Now the real question is, how is high quality defined, right? What's the real definition of high quality? Is how much you pay for it, how big it is? I mean, there is a concept of hiddur mitzvah, right? There is a concept of beautifying a mitzvah, nice talis, nice tefillin. Right? And a lot of that has to do with us, in the sense of the nicer something is, the more esteem and the more valuable it is to us, the more it means to us. That's the way we are as people. That's the way we are. But the real essential way of grading your service to Hashem comes from later on. And that is, you take a look on page 548. Okay, this is talking about, and when your burnt offering is not from cattle, it's not from sheep, it's from a bird. And basically the pasuk says that when you bring a bird, you go ahead, let's take a look at pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17. V'shisa oisai bechnafav lo yavdil. You have to split it without splitting it completely, and you offer it that way. Okay, you split it with its feathers, but you don't split it the whole way. And after all is said and done, The pasuk says, "Oyluhu, it's a burnt offering, isherech nechayach laHashem, a fire offering of a sweet aroma to Hashem." Okay. Now, this phrase, "isherech nechayach laHashem," a fire offering, a pleasant aroma to Hashem. You find that after the bird offering, you find it after the animal offering. And Rashi comments, "Nemar ba'oifrech nechayach ve'behemarech nechayach." Both by a bird and both by an animal, it says a sweet swelling aroma to Hashem. Which means no matter what you bring, right, it's still pleasant and still dear to Hashem. Loimar to teach us, echad amar mevechad amamit, whether you're giving a lot, whether you're giving a little, that doesn't matter. Ubelvad sheyachav nasib l'shamayim, as long as your focus is, your intent is to serve Hashem. It's not about how much you give, it's about how you give it. Okay? Whether you bring the animal sacrifice, whether you bring the bird sacrifice, it's all about focusing. If your intent, you're sincere, this is your sincere way of serving Hashem, that's what matters, not how big it is. And no matter how big or small it is, yet again, you know, no blemishes, even though you don't have that by birds anyway. So the thing is like this. Okay, so it says, okay, whether I give a little, whether I give a lot, as long as I mean to serve Hashem. All right. So you have this guy, right? He's got plenty of money, right? And he says, you know, I'm just going to give the small thing. You know why? Because I mean it to God, right? I want to serve Hashem. I mean to serve Hashem. So what's the difference if I give something big, if I give something small? What's the difference? And the halacha is that a person who can afford more is supposed to give the bigger animal. The person who can afford more can't just say, well, you know, my heart's there, right? My heart's there. I'm a chabinu l'shamayim. Am I focused on God? Am I trying to serve Hashem? Yeah. So what's the difference about giving the big one, the small one, the more expensive, less expensive? What's the difference? Right? My heart's there. Right? What do you say about a Jew who all the Judaism is in his heart? He has a heart attack. His heart can't take all that.
Some people don't have a
You know? Heart. Can't take all that. The point is that it's very easy to say, yeah, it doesn't make a difference, big or small. Of course I mean to serve Hashem. At the end of the day, right, everybody knows that if you can afford more, you're going to pay more for something that you like. That's what you're going to do. If you can afford more and something is important to you and you could spend more money on it, you're going to spend more money on it. So if you could afford the bigger animal, yeah, that's what you should do. That is what you should do. Because if you could afford more, then you should be serving Hashem with more. But the person who can't serve Hashem with more, he only has a little to serve Hashem. If he's serving Hashem in the best way that he can, Hashem has the same nachas, Hashem has the same pleasure as the big animal that the rich man brought. Because it's about heart, it's about where is your heart, but where your heart really is based on how much you can do. That's where it is. If you can do more and you didn't do more, don't tell me your heart's there. Because if your heart is there, you do more, because anywhere where your heart is, you do more. And therefore, the measuring stick of the high quality that we're saying here is the real measuring stick, or the measuring stick that's most important quality, and yes, is a quality, is doing the best that you can. Doing the best that you can. Doing what you can and doing it sincerely, that is the highest quality form of service you can do for Hashem. And if when you have more money and you can use and you can spend more money, then again, if your heart is in it, you really want to do it, you're going to do more. Because why? Because that's how we work. That's how we are. This is how we do things. When something is important to us, something has value, we're ready to pay more for it. So if we could do more, then we should do more. Because that really expresses, that brings out in us what's really important, what something really means to us. That's the way we are as human beings. So for the person who could do more, that person has to do what he can. And for the person who can only do less, that person has to do what he can. And when he does what he can, and his whole heart is in it, and he's doing whatever he can sincerely, with true dedication to Hashem, that is as dear and as precious to Hashem as the big carbon that the other person gave.
But is there a difference between animal or bird?
It depends how much you can afford.
No, but if, for example, I am so poor, I only have bird.
So that's all you bring?
But
for this carbon, for this sacrifice.
For this sacrifice.
And then if you're even poorer than that, you can't have it, you can't bring an animal, you bring a meal offering. You bring the oil and the flour.
But Torah mentioned about now blemish only about animal. There is no anything about bird.
Right.
But this is it's default. Birds also should be of high quality.
If I would, I would think that the if we want to give a reason why the Torah doesn't have a problem with blemishes by a bird, is similar to the fact that the Torah says that when you bring the bird, you don't take off its feathers. You offer with its feathers.
These feathers.
The feathers of the bird. You don't pluck the feathers off. You offer it with the feathers. Because we're trying to, because at the end of the day, we're trying to make the sacrifice of the poor man seem more substantial. Give it more substance. So clearly for the person who's bringing the bird, who doesn't have a lot of money, the Torah tried to make it easier for him. The Torah wanted to give him more chance to go ahead and bring the animal. So therefore, the Torah here let go the idea of the blemish.
You go back to kind.